board that regulates self-growth division events.
Well, thank you, Vito. I think it's going to be impossible to live up to that. I wish my wife were here to hear that. Is it on tape? Maybe we could. Is the sound okay? Yeah. Actually, I'm not going to talk about yeast. I actually, I'm going to be talking about cancer and about breast cancer, because what I've been hoping for 10 or 15 years has finally happened, and that is I'm involved now in a consortium of investigators who are studying the systems biology of breast cancer. This group is led by Bob Clark at Georgetown University Medical School and his team of experimentalists and clinicians and molecular biologists. And at Virginia Tech, there are a number of us involved in this group. Bill Bowman, Joe Wang, and Jason Zuan are all in the electrical engineering department. And Joseph and Jason are doing the bioinformatics in this project, and Bill Bowman and I are doing the modeling. And this is a brand new collaboration. It's only been going for about 6 months, and I kind of want to give you an idea of what we have in mind and the approaches that we're taking. And I think it'll become obvious how this derived from work I've been doing recently in yeast cells and also in mammalian cells. So let me first describe the work that Clark and Wang and Zhuan were doing with cancer cells at Georgetown Medical School. They're interested in the estrogen signaling network, and at Georgetown they have this panel of cells derived from MCF7 cells, which is a breast epithelial cell line. The MCF7 cells are estrogen dependent and drug sensitive. They're only partially transformed. And from MCF7, Clark's group derived a number of further cell lines, in particular LCC1, which these cells are estrogen independent but still drug sensitive, and LCC2 and LCC9, which are estrogen independent and drug resistant. And they're resistant to two different drugs, tamoxifen and Faslodex, which are used clinically to treat breast cancers. And what Clark and his group did was pretty standard transcriptomics of these cell lines. So they look at all the different genes that are being expressed, look at the messenger RNA patterns of expression in these different cell lines, and then the bioinformaticians massage the data and try to come up with some conclusions. And what they basically found is that there are a number of transcription factors which are co-regulated along with the estrogen receptor in this panel of cells. And the ones that stood out as most important are NF-kappa-B, which is not surprising, AP1, which is phosgene transcription factor for cell proliferation, and then these two other transcription factors, IRF1, involved in apoptosis, and XBP1, involved in the unfolded protein response and autophagy. And so they brought us into this project to see what we could tell them about our understanding of how these different aspects of cell growth and death and cell division are controlled from a molecular point of view, and what our models can say about the relationships among these different characters. So that's how the collaboration got started. And so now switch gears a little bit and say, you know, what my basic take on this is from a theoretical point of view. In all these situations, certainly for breast cancer cells, I like to think of the cell as an information processing system. It's receiving information from lots of different sources. It processes that information and has to make decisions. Okay? So in particular, a breast epithelial cell will receive information from growth factors and from hormones like estrogen, and also from its tissue context. So the epithelial cells talk to the stromal cells, and it also experiences different kinds of stress. It may undergo hypoxic stress or DNA damage. All of these things are sensed and transmitted to the cell, and the cell has to make decisions about whether it's going to grow and divide, what genes are going to be expressed, how it's going to deal with stress, and ultimately sometimes the cell may have to commit suicide. We would like to understand how these signals are processed, how these decisions are made, especially in the context of breast epithelial cells, normal cells, and transformed cells. Well, what do we know about this information processing network? We know it's quite complicated. We know many of the principal players. This is the way I like to display this information processing system from my point of view. This is not complete by any means, but it's some of the major players that we're interested in right now. Now, a network of chemical reactions like this, of macromolecular interactions, is pretty challenging to understand in all of its complexity. It's a big mouthful to chew and digest at once, and it's probably best to try to break it down into individual pieces that are a little bit more manageable. So let's focus on a couple of the components of this information processing system. So first, I'll identify the cell cycle regulatory network, and we heard a lot about this yesterday from Steve Haas in the context of budding yeast cells. But as Steve mentioned, there are a lot of similarities between the control system in budding yeast and the control system in mammalian cells. And in particular, we're keeping track of these major cyclins, cyclin E, cyclin A, and cyclin B, that control the G1S transition, that initiate DNA synthesis, that initiate the mitotic events, and eventually cell division. So the cell cycle regulatory network, if we can follow the comings and goings of all these different components, we can figure out how the cells are progressing through the cell cycle. And with Tung Li Zhang and Jerry Ostheimer, we're working on a new model that we think has some improvements for keeping track of these events of the cell cycle in mammalian cells. But I don't want to talk actually about cell cycle control today, about actually the getting through the cell cycle successfully, but I want to concentrate on some of the upstream regulatory signals that determine whether the cell is actually going to enter the cell cycle or not, because that's the important decision as far as cancer is concerned. Because actually cancer cells get through the cell cycle more or less okay, right? If they didn't, they would die and it wouldn't be a problem. The problem is in the upstream controls that determine whether the cell is going to proliferate or not. To understand those controls, I think one thing we have to do is focus on the retinoblastoma protein in this network, which is right here in the center, and it's the major break on growth and division, at least from my point of view. This is how I'm understanding these things, and I'll be glad to have feedback, especially critical feedback, to correct my misunderstanding. But the RB protein is an inhibitor of transcription. In particular, RB binds to transcription factors of the E2F family, which are important in upregulating the expression of cyclin E and cyclin A, the early cyclins in the cell cycle. So when RB is active, the cell can't enter the cell cycle because these E2F transcription factors are inhibited. But RB is also a general inhibitor of ribosomal RNA transcription, so it puts the brakes on the production of new ribosomes, which prevents the cell from growing. So it's preventing both growth and cell division, cell cycle. So that's why it's such an important protein, actually, and why the RB protein, probably why the RB protein is mutated in so many cancers, because when the RB protein is mutated, this important break is taken off, and it's much easier for cells to grow and proliferate in an uncontrolled fashion. Now, how is this break supposed to be released? So this break is supposed to be controlled by an upstream signal transduction network that's receiving information from lots of different sources from outside the cell. And this information is then communicated to the cell, and it's going to control growth and division. So for instance, there are signals which pass through PI3K and ACT kinase to kind of turn on the protein synthetic machinery. So that would rev up the growth of the cell. And there are other signals which pass through MAP kinase pathway and other pathways to upregulate the transcription factors MYC and FOS and JUN, which drive the production of cyclin D. And the cyclin D-dependent kinase phosphorylates the retinoblastoma protein and turns off the retinoblastoma protein. So from this point of view, cyclin D is the handle by which you you disengage the emergency brake on growth and division. And the proliferation signals are trying to turn on the production of cyclin D. There are also anti-proliferation signals, which are trying to turn off the activity of cyclin D. And whether the cell is going to proliferate or not is some kind of a balance between the pro-proliferation and anti-proliferation signals. In fact, you might think of this upstream regulatory signaling network as trying to compute a Boolean function on cyclin D, where cyclin D is on if there's a sufficient amount of pro-proliferation signals and not anti-proliferation signals. And the not anti-proliferation is quite important. If there are signals that tell the cell that it's not allowed to grow and divide, they have to dominate. And those signals come in two ways, at least. Some of these anti-proliferation signals are carried out by inhibiting transcription factors for cyclin D, so kind of down-regulating the expression of cyclin D. But even more important and more powerful are those signals that upregulate the production of inhibitors of cyclin D-dependent kinase activity, like P15. Okay, so that's a powerful inhibitor of cyclin D. So even if the pro-proliferation signals have caused the production of cyclin D, this anti-proliferation signal can just kill that activity and keep the cell from proliferating. Okay, now a lot of different people have studied these pathways and modeled these pathways, and we're trying to search the literature to find the best models, the models that we like, and try to patch these models together in a way that's sensible for breast cancer cells. We're still working on this, and I don't have anything to report on it right now. Instead, I want to come back to this control of the retinoblastoma protein and the decision about whether the cell is going to enter the cell cycle or not. And in mammalian cell physiology, this is called the restriction point control. So I want to talk a little bit about just these few reactions that are controlling the activity of the retinoblastoma protein. Now, as I said, the RB protein binds to and inhibits E2F transcription factors, which are driving the production of cyclin E. So as long as RB is active, you're not going to enter the cell cycle. The job of cyclin D-dependent kinase is to phosphorylate RB and kind of turn off RB. That allows E2F to gain some activity and produce cyclin E. Cyclin E binds to its kinase partner, and cyclin E-dependent kinase can also phosphorylate the RB protein and downregulate the RB protein even further. So as you can see, there's a little three-component positive feedback loop here, and it's quite possible that that positive feedback loop can generate a bistable control system. You can have one stable steady state where the RB protein is active, E2F is off, and there's no cyclin E. That's the G1, early G1 phase of the cell cycle, or the G0, the quiescent phase of the cell cycle. And then the other state of this switch would be RB off, E2F on, and cyclin E on, and then the cell would be trying to leave G1 and enter into S phase. So this idea was pursued in a very nice paper coming out of Duke by Guang Yao and Ling Chan Yu, published in Nature Cell Biology a couple years ago, where they wrote a set of differential equations to describe this little control system and see how it behaves. And as expected, for appropriate and reasonable choices of the rate constants in the network, this little network can show a bistable response of the E2F activity as a function of serum, which contains the growth factor that's trying to turn on the cell cycle. So if you look at the E2F solution, you see There can be this low, stable, steady state that's off and a high, stable, steady state that's on. Whereas if you look at cyclin D is just responding in a monotone fashion as you increase the serum. Okay? So cyclin D, in a sense here, is a measure of the serum, of the serum strength, and it's communicating that to this little positive feedback loop. And it'll only turn on if you get enough cyclin D activity, and then you can flip the switch to the on state. So this group from Duke did some very nice experiments to confirm this prediction of the model. They serum starve cells at time less than zero. The cells are serum starved, so they're in a quiescent state. RB is active. This little switch is in the off state. And then in the red experiments at time zero, they just wash the cells and resuspend them in serum of different concentrations. And if you look at the red curves, here they're following the amount, it's the amount of cyclin D and the activity of E2F in cells at different final concentrations of serum. You see, as you dial up the serum, you get a monotone response of cyclin D. You just get more and more cyclin D as you dial up the serum. But if you look at the E2F signal at low serum, you just E2F is off, 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 and finally you get a few cells that are on, and then you get more and more cells that are on, and at high serum you get a lot of cells that are on. But in particular here, there's definitely indication of a bistable response. Some of the cells are still off, some of the cells are on. That's when you dial up the serum, and then you can do the reverse experiment at time zero. You put the cells into very high serum, 20% serum for 5 hours, then you resuspend them in a lower final serum concentration. So initially you try to kick all the cells into the on state and then bring the serum level down. That's kind of the opposite. And what you see is if you bring it down very low, the cells go back to the off state, but even at these intermediate serum levels, a lot of the cells will stay on. If you push them on, then they'll stay on even if you pull them to low serum. But again, further indication of the bistable character or nature of this decision process. You with me? Any questions about this? So I like to think of this as this little information processing is something like what's done in neurons, right? Because in a neuron, the dendritic tree is receiving inputs, excitatory and inhibitory inputs into the dendritic tree. And the soma of the neuron sums up those inputs. And the membrane potential of the soma fluctuates up and down. As it gets excitation, the membrane potential goes up. And as it gets inhibition, the membrane potential goes down. But eventually, if there's enough excitation, if there's more pro than anti, that membrane potential will fluctuate above a certain threshold, and that threshold will then trigger an action potential. And once the action potential is triggered, then it just runs down the axon, and the cell has to, you know, then the neuron has to recover, and it can process a new set of signals. So something maybe similar is happening here, where you have pro-proliferation signals and anti-proliferation signals coming down and being integrated and read out as the level of cyclin D, and that fluctuating level of cyclin D, when it passes the threshold, can flip this switch. But once the switch gets flipped, then it holds for a significant length of time in the on state, enough for the cell to do one cell cycle. Okay. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about DNA damage control and the death pathways. So we know DNA damage is sensed by this transcription factor, P53. And in the normal undamaged cell, the level of P53 is kept very low by a protein called MDM2, which promotes the degradation of P53. And these two components are hooked in a little negative feedback loop. So if the P53 level fluctuates up a little bit by accident, it'll make more MDM2, and the MDM2 will pull the P53 level back down again. So this is a little homeostatic mechanism to keep P53 low in the undamaged cell. If the DNA in the cell is damaged, then sensor pathways pick up that damage and communicate it They either upregulate P53 or downregulate MDM2 or some combination of the two, and they allow the P53 level to go up. Then P53 has three jobs to do. First of all, P53 upregulates repair enzymes that try to fix the DNA damage. And if the damage gets fixed, then everything is fine. P53 goes away, it did its job, and the cell can proceed. Okay? The other thing that P53 needs to do immediately is to upregulate the production of this inhibitor, P21. P21 is a powerful inhibitor of cyclin D. So immediately when P53 senses DNA damage, it puts the brakes on cyclin D to prevent a cell from entering the cell cycle and from trying to replicate the DNA, because the DNA is damaged. Okay? If the damage gets repaired, then P53 goes away, you turn off the production of P21, P21 is degraded, everything's fine, then the cell's allowed, at least from that point of view, to enter the cell cycle. If the damage cannot be repaired in a reasonable length of time, apparently, then P53 upregulates the expression of proteins of a family of proteins called the BH3 proteins. And the BH3 proteins are pro-death proteins. They're trying to activate this protein Bax in the mitochondrial membrane. And when Bax gets activated, it opens pores in the outer mitochondrial membrane, and a bunch of proteins escape from the mitochondria, SMAC and cytochrome C, and those proteins then initiate this pathway, which ultimately activates caspase 3, which is an executioner protease, which begins chopping up proteins in the cell and committing the cell to apoptotic death. So that's the programmed cell death pathway. Again, there are a number of different signaling pathways that affect whether the cell is going to commit suicide or not. So there are pro-death signals. I described the one that comes from DNA damage through P53. That's called the intrinsic pathway of programmed cell death. There's also an extrinsic pathway. So there are death factors that cells can secrete. And if another cell has a receptor for the death factors and it sees the death factors, they activate caspase 8. Caspase 8 activates a protein called BID, which is a BH3 protein, which is trying to turn on Bax and initiate the death pathway from extrinsic factors. But there are also pro-survival signals that are coming from other extracellular ligands and communicated through other pathways, in particular through NF-kappa-B, which is a powerful pro-survival transcription factor. It's upregulating proteins of the BCL family, and they are inhibitors of BH3 proteins, so they prevent the initiation of this pathway, and also these proteins, IAP proteins, inhibitors of apoptosis. So again, we have the same sort of a story here, where we have excitatory and inhibitory signals coming in, being integrated, and if the pro-death signals outweigh the pro-survival signals, somehow a decision is made that commits the cell to this death pathway. So let's talk a little bit about this cell death decision module. And this is work I did with Tong Li Zhang and Paul Brozhnik a couple years ago. So here's the little module that we think sits in the front of the programmed cell death pathway. And this is an interesting little module. Remember, Bax is the crucial protein here. When Bax gets activated, it permeabilizes the mitochondrial outer membrane, and as I'll describe in a second, once that happens, the cell is a goner, right? So all very hard to call it back, once you permeabilize the mitochondrial membrane. But the activation of Bax is inhibited by the BCL proteins. They bind to Bax and they keep Bax inactive. And in order to turn Bax on, you need proteins from the BH3 class. Now, if you look at this little module, it has some interesting features. First of all, it has two double negative feedback loops, as indicated in the red. It also has a three-component positive feedback loop. Both of these, or all of these interactions, tend to create a bistable switch. Would you have BACs in the off state as a stable steady state, and BACs, activated BACs, is also a stable steady state. And thirdly, this little motif has a coherent feed-forward loop from BH3 to BACs, which tends to dampen out fluctuations in the BH3 proteins. You have to get a significant amount of activatory signal over a long period of time to turn BACs on. So we built a little differential equation model of this motif and studied its signal processing capabilities. And as expected, for reasonable choices of the rate constants, it also shows bistable response to the total level of BH3 proteins, which we're thinking of as a measure of the stress that the cell is experiencing. So if the stress is low, then the cell sits at a stable steady state with BACs off, and that's stable with respect to small fluctuations in the stress. They won't cause the cell to commit suicide. But if the stress level is raised to a high state, then the BACs gets activated in a very characteristic fashion. So that would be like the firing of the nerve axon. Okay? Now, what you see clearly is that the stress has to be raised above the saddle node bifurcation in order to get the switch to flip to the on state. And it's not hard to believe that the location of that saddle node bifurcation depends upon the amount of BCL proteins that you have. So if the cell has more BCL proteins, you raise that threshold. If the cell has less BCL proteins, you lower that threshold. You make it easier to commit suicide. So the threshold is controlled by BCL, and the stress then determines how much BH3 proteins you're going to make. And in order to commit suicide, at least in this picture, you have to get more BH3 than BCL in order to pass that that threshold. It's a simple titration kind of a mechanism. Okay. Yeah. Question. It can be, I didn't want to specify, okay? It could be that you're making more BCL proteins or you're activating them somehow. And there's all different kinds of BCL proteins with different strengths, and they interact with different proteins from the BH. So I've just lumped everything together to kind of give an idea. To actually build a model that's going to explain experiments in a particular kind of cell, I think we're going to have to be much more... We have to spell out exactly what we mean, but I think the general picture of how the information is processed is, I hope it's correct, because this is the way we think it's going to work. Well, we haven't done it yet. I'm just telling you what we think we're going to do, and how I think the information is handled in all of these different pathways. Okay, now. If you are going to commit to suicide, then it happens in a very characteristic way. After you get the signal, for a long period of time, you still don't have any active BACs until you get past that threshold. And then once you get past the threshold, BACs activates pretty rapidly, and that permeabilizes the mitochondrial membrane, and then then you're committed to cell death in this picture. And this is exactly what's observed in some beautiful experiments that were done in Peter Sorger's lab at MIT and then later at Harvard Med School, studying programmed cell death in response to an external death ligand trail. Okay, so the cells were exposed to this death ligand, and then they monitor the activity of caspase-3. And when the cells change color from blue to yellow, that's when caspase-3 gets activated, and it gets activated very rapidly, and the cells commit suicide. But look at the dependence upon the trail concentration. If the death ligand concentration is very low, those are the green ones, then there's a very long lag time before you get past the bifurcation point. But once you pass the bifurcation point, then the cell death process occurs very rapidly. So they call this snap action. Once BACs gets activated, then the execution module occurs quite rapidly. And as you increase the death ligand concentration, then what happens is you shorten the time to commitment to suicide, because you move faster in this direction, you can cross that threshold faster. Okay? So this is the way we understand these experiments. I think I have to say, though, that Sorger's group interprets his experiments a little bit differently than we do. That's fine. I mean, they show that you can get rid of the positive feedback loop here so that it's not a bistable switch and it still looks exactly the same. And I think that's because there are other options for bistability at other places in the mechanism, although they don't believe that either. They have a completely different interpretation. You should read their paper to get their point of view. Is that fair enough, Jerry? Okay. Now, let's talk about estrogen signaling, because this is important for breast cancer cells. How do breast epithelial cells respond to estrogen? And what I'm going to describe is a model that was done by a talented graduate student in my lab named Chun Chen. So, estrogen is a steroid hormone. It's lipid-soluble. It doesn't need a membrane receptor. It just passes right through the membrane. And it binds to an estrogen receptor, ER-alpha, estrogen receptor alpha. That's a nuclear hormone receptor. And when it binds to estrogen, it gets activated, and it's pro-survival, pro-proliferation. Okay, so the proliferation of breast epithelial cells is dependent upon estrogen. And of course, the breast has to expand and retract as a woman goes through pregnancy cycles. Okay, when she becomes pregnant, the breasts enlarge, and after the baby is weaned, the breast shrinks. Okay, and this is partly driven by hormone signals in the bloodstream. Now, many breast cancer cells are estrogen dependent. They still have estrogen dependence, okay, and they still have the estrogen receptor, and they still need estrogen to survive and proliferate. So therefore, many breast cancers are sensitive to endocrine therapy. And there are two kinds of endocrine therapies. There are small molecules that inhibit the production, the enzymes that produce estrogen, so they drive the estrogen level down, and there are other drugs that bind to and inhibit the estrogen receptor. But in either case, they block these pro-survival, pro-proliferation signals, and the tumors shrink. So they would be sensitive to endocrine therapy. But in many cases, unfortunately, the tumor cells become resistant to endocrine therapy, and they can become resistant in a number of different ways. There's acquired resistance, and what's the other kind? Slipped my mind. That doesn't matter. We want to talk about just one possible mechanism for cells to become resistant to endocrine therapy, and that might be because there's another pathway by which the cells can promote survival and proliferation, even if they're not getting signaling through estrogen. And we think NF-kappa-B is a good candidate. There seems to be a mutual inhibition between signaling through the estrogen receptor and signaling through NF-kappa-B. Now, I'm not saying what carries out this inhibition. I'm just saying the data indicates that when the estrogen receptor is active and doing its job, NF-kappa-B tends to be low, and vice versa, in breast epithelium. So when a cell is being driven by estrogen, signaling through the estrogen receptor, NF-kappa-B levels are kept low. But it could be that if you try to apply endocrine therapy and knock out signaling through estrogen, you remove the inhibition on NF-kappa-B, and now NF-kappa-B can come up and take the place and continue to promote survival and proliferation, and that would account for resistance to endocrine therapy. So we tried to model this little control motif in a particular way, and we like these kinds of equations because they're really easy to handle. We write a differential equation of this form for each of the components in our system. In this case, it's just the estrogen receptor and NF-kappa-B. And the terms in the equation just represent synthesis and degradation, or activation and inactivation. I'm not really saying what it is. We don't particularly know. And then there's a parameter gamma that controls the time scale, the response of the particular components. The nonlinear function here that describes, say, synthesis or activation is a generic sigmoidal function with two parameters, epsilon that controls the background level and S that controls the sigmoidicity of this response function. And W is just a linear combination of the signals that the cell is getting. Okay, so there's an offset. So this function is like a little switch, right? If W is less than zero, then G is off. If W is bigger than zero, then G is on. And the constant here, the offset, controls whether the switch is on or off when there's not receiving any input. Yi is the external input from estrogen or from cytokines. And what's interesting is the stuff in the middle, which is describing how the components of the little network are interacting with each other. And, you know, all we're really setting out is the sign pattern of this interaction that represents the topology of the little signal processing motif. Now, we can explore the signal processing capabilities of this little network by exploring the parameter space. There's only a limited number of parameters here, and we know what the ranges of these parameters ought to be. And with a couple hours on the computer, you can just do random searches through this parameter space and get an idea of what it's going to do. This is the kind of response that we're looking for, estrogen resistance. That is, when the cells are exposed to estrogen, the estrogen receptor should be active and NF-kappa B inactive. And when you remove estrogen, of course, ER signaling goes down, but now it's taken over by NF-kappa B. And this can happen either because the system is responding in a monostable fashion to estrogen or perhaps in a bistable fashion. Both are possible depending upon the parameter values in the control system. Now, there is evidence for bimodal distribution of estrogen receptors in MCF7 cells. So here's a flow cytometric determination of estrogen receptors in intact cells, and you want to look at this bimodal histogram. So there are lots of receptor-rich cells, and there are lots of receptor-poor cells in a bimodal kind of a distribution. So these are just cells, normal cells in some sort of normal conditions, but some of them have lots of estrogen receptor, some of them have very little estrogen receptor. And that's also nicely illustrated in this photo from the literature. Is this estrogen receptor detection by immunofluorescence, and you can see most cells have plenty of estrogen receptor in the nucleus, but if you look carefully, there are a couple of cells here that have very little estrogen receptor in the nucleus. They're all treated the same, they're all the same MCF7 cells. Most of them have plenty of estrogen receptor, but some of them have hardly any. Okay, it looks like there is indeed a bimodal distribution of estrogen receptor in MCF7 cells. Now, we'd like to test this because, as we know theoretically, if the system is bimodal, what you want to do is follow what happens when you, well, usually what you're doing is decreasing estrogen, right? You grow them in estrogen, then you remove the estrogen, and you want to see how they switch over to NF-kappa B signaling. But then you'd also like to do the opposite experiment. Whoops, the opposite experiment where you increase the estrogen and they're going to follow a different path. But they're going to go through this bimodal regime, but in very different ways. So here are some simulations that Chun Chen did for his model in the case where it's showing a bimodal response. And these are just simulated flow cytometry experiments for MCF7. This is not an experiment. This is a simulation. This is our prediction, and we're trying to convince Clark and his group to do this experiment. But if you decrease estrogen, when estrogen gets low enough, you'll start to see this bimodal distribution. So it'll split up into two different populations. And as estrogen is increasing, you'll also see regions of estrogen levels where there's a bimodal distribution, but an entirely different place. I'm not saying what we're reading. It's probably, because I don't know, okay? It could be. Yeah. That's what I would suggest. But for estrogen, it's probably, for the estrogen receptor, it's probably the amount, right? Because of the, you know, I showed you that there are estrogen receptor rich and poor cells. Okay, I'm almost done and I'm right on time, I think. That's a miracle.
I'm spellbound.
I want to come back to this slide that I started with, because we've been focusing on proliferation and apoptosis and how it's controlled by pro-survival and anti-survival, pro-death and anti-death factors, how those factors are integrated, how the decision is made by a bistable kind of a switch. All this makes perfect sense to me. What didn't make any sense to me when we first started talking with Clark, and what was a big surprise to us, and I think to them, is this other transcription factor that kind of came out of the blue, XBP1. I'd never even heard of it before, but there's a very strong correlation between estrogen receptor and XBP1, a positive correlation in these cell lines. And what does XBP1 do? XBP1 is involved in something called the unfolded protein response, which is a measure of stress in the endoplasmic reticulum. So these are proteins that are destined for membranes or for secretion. They're made in the ER, and if the cell is under stress, these ER proteins will get misfolded. And you can tell when they're misfolded, and there are a bunch of other proteins called chaperones, which then rush over to these misfolded proteins and wrap their loving arms around them and try to coax them into folding up into the proper conformation. And if they can't do that, then the proteins will get degraded. Okay, so it's a response mechanism. And it's because the cell is under stress, under duress, and we need to do something with these misfolded proteins. Okay. At the same time, the unfolded protein response is very closely correlated with a response called autophagy. In autophagy, it means self-eating. The autophagic response produces these kind of autophagosomes, which start digesting cellular proteins. So the cell starts eating itself. But why does it do this? It does this probably under stress because it needs energy and it needs the raw materials to rescue itself. Okay, so autophagy is turned up. And autophagy is not primarily a death response. Autophagy is a survival response under duress. Okay, but if things get really bad, autophagy can lead to cell death. So that's autophagic cell death as opposed to apoptotic cell death. They're entirely different cell death pathways. And I'll say there's a third, or there may be a third cell death pathway called necrotic cell death, although still people argue whether that's a real pathway or whether that's just a nasty consequence. But at any rate, we also need to understand and integrate into this total picture the unfolded protein response and the response of autophagy. And we haven't done this yet, but the first thing I did was assign that problem to two of my students. And so Iman Tavasoli, who's back here in the shadows, is working on autophagy, and Anil Ferdugo is working on the unfolded protein response. This is Chan Chen, who's doing the estrogen signaling, and Tang Li Zhang, who was in my group for years and years, and now I handed him over to Bela Novak in Oxford, and he's enjoying his time there. The work was supported by NSF and NIH, and there are references to all the papers I talked about. Thank you very much.